Over the past 2 hours, we've had lots of information, prayer points, challenges from countries all around the world. And my allotted task in this last session is to bring a challenge for ourselves. I'm going to base some of my comments on Micah chapter 5, the last few verses, verses 10 to 15. One of the things you may have noticed this afternoon, and it's one of the things we notice as we travel around and get correspondence from all sorts of countries where we send books, one of the things we notice is that much of this growth that is taking place around the world is taking place through one-on-one evangelism. It's one of the questions I ask people when I visit countries where we're seeing great growth. What is at the core of this growth? And although there may be evangelistic enterprises, outreach in mass evangelism or in church programs and campaigns of one sort or another, most of it is coming through the personal witness of Christians, what we call one-on-one evangelism. And I'm still convinced that this is the best way that we can do it in our country. We should be using our homes, our backyards, our associations, our friendships. But in most cases, we will do anything except that. We will think about maybe having some special meetings at the church or some special outreach project. But to get people into our homes or to get them onto our property, that is the thing we seem to avoid. That is our castle. That is our independent area. We want to keep it to ourselves. We are remarkably unfriendly when it comes to bringing people into our homes, establishing relationships with the aim of bringing these people to know Christ. The result is that we deceive ourselves by thinking that we're doing evangelism when in fact we're not evangelizing at all. We're simply going to church and maybe lending our moral support to some church programs. Or if we're church leaders, we have a meeting about evangelism and what we should do, and we think that that is evangelism. We have a meeting about it, to talk about it, instead of actually doing it. So that's one of the results of our lack of enterprise and our deceiving ourselves. The second thing is that we become ingrown. We become complacent. We simply maintain status quo. We are satisfied with the lifestyle that we have in this country. We enjoy the standard of living, the prosperity, the security, and so we become complacent, we become selfish, we become ingrown, and all we are contented with is to keep things as they are. And as long as things can stay as they are, then we're quite happy. And so the church in Australia is really reaching out to very few. Worse than that, most Christians are not even concerned about it. It doesn't even bother their conscience. It doesn't upset them that we are reaching out to very few, that we're not making progress. And many of them are simply not interested. They're not interested in evangelism in our own country, and they're not really all that interested in finding out what is happening in other places either. And when we suggest that we do something, if we suggest that we could change our lifestyle or change our church activities or change our mentality or change our mindset, then people will have every reason not to do it. And if we have, even in our churches, we decide we are going to make some special outreach, you will find very quickly that people will have reasons not to do it. It doesn't suit this part of my program, or I have children that require me to do something, or the weather is too hot, or it's too cold, or it's the wrong time of the year, or there's some other event that's going to clash with what we want to do. And it goes on, and we will very quickly see that people will have every excuse not to do evangelism. Maybe what God has got to do is to shake us. Perhaps we need a catastrophe of some sort. Perhaps we need some divine intervention. I've been saying for years that it seems to me the Western world is heading for some terrible judgment. Now, I'm not a prophet, not the predicting variety, and I'm not going to try to say how it might happen, but it just seems to me that the way we have squandered our resources and our opportunities, the West that had the Christianity for so long, that led the evangelization of the world a couple of hundred years ago when William Carey broke out of the complacency of the church and started to move into other countries. The West was the springboard. It was the launching pad for much of the evangelization that took place over those couple of hundred years until we get to the present, and now the West is bogged down. It's lost the plot. and it's lost the vision, it's lost the energy, and it's settled into a very comfortable, convenient way of life. The thrust from world evangelization is no longer coming from the West. It's coming from other parts of the world. But these other parts of the world are in all sorts of strife, politically and economically and socially and religiously. There's conflict and there's chaos, and there are difficulties of one sort or another. And here is the West, we're squandering our resources. We are living in the lap of luxury. We are spending the money on ourselves. We are going through program after program that is advancing our own standard of living and doing very, very little about the rest of the world. But I'm not just speaking here of the church. I'm speaking of the West in general. And the church, unfortunately, has got the disease of society in general. When you see the waste and the disproportion in the world, so many people that can't even get the basics to live with. And here we are in the West, wasting it in the most ridiculous programs, whether they're sporting events or the amounts of money we pay entertainers or sportspersons or politicians or big business executives, or we carry out all of this cosmetic surgery when half the people in the world can't even get aspirin or worm medicine or something basic like that. And you look at the disgusting amounts of money that are just wasted in all sorts of pursuits that are following the life of self-indulgence and satisfaction. And then we see three-quarters of the world and the dreadful conditions that people are facing. And you think to yourself, goodness me, the West must be headed for some terrible judgment. Now we can look back to the events of last year, September the 11th, as it's come to be known, Osama bin Laden and all that. What I'm speaking on today, actually the first time I preached this sermon, the only time I have preached this sermon or the material I'm giving you, was about 2 years ago, long before we had ever dreamed that something such as September the 11th would happen. So I'm not saying these things now to say, oh, there you are. Everybody said this is a wake-up call that has been sent. All I'm doing is repeating things that I said a long time ago, and I'm not saying that I was a predictor or a prophet that had foreseen those events of September the 11th. But surely it is not surprising. I mean, George Bush, he stands up here and he says, why do they hate us? And I think to myself, man, where have you been? Why do they hate us? I'm astounded that they don't hate us a lot more. The resentment that must build up in some of these countries, and when it's driven by religious fanaticism, then it is just all the more likely that people sooner or later are going to explode. In the book of Micah, we see how the people of Israel have been promised a good future. That's in the first part of chapter 5. And then as he moves through, he says how this nation is going to bring blessing to other people. But first of all, the nation had to go through a terrible judgment. The captivity, the destruction of Jerusalem and all of those things, as God stripped from those people everything that they previously depended upon. Their wealth, their might, their foreign neighbors who had good armies, the idolatry that they trusted in, all of the things that they falsely put their hopes in. God one by one took all those things away until the people were left with nothing and said, we only have God. I'm going to read through very quickly. Verse 10, chapter 5, verse 10 of Micah. In that day says the Lord, I'm going to cut off all these things you depended upon. All the hindrances to faith. That's what they are. Hindrances to faith. We have them in this country, and these are the things that have weakened the church. Hindrances to faith. I'm going to cut off your horses and chariots. Your military strength, you trusted in that. I'm going to cut it off. Verse 11. I'm going to cut off your cities and your land, all the commercial activity in the cities, all the agricultural activity in the countries. They depended upon these things for their prosperity, for their growth, for their national economy. I'm going to cut those off also, says God. I'm going to throw down your strongholds. Ah, you thought you were secure. You thought you had firepower. You thought you had defenses. You thought that you could stand there in the face of attacks and still be strong. I'm going to cut them off too. Verse 12, the sorceries and the soothsayers, spiritism, the occult, new age, call it what you wish. All of these fringe things that are coming out of a religious hunger within people, but not seeking it in the living God. seeking it in spiritism and sorcery and soothsayers, fortune tellers and images. All of those things I'm going to cut off. Verse 12, false gods, your pillars, Asherim, all these bits and pieces of false religion that they had accumulated around them. Going to take all those away too, says God. Going to destroy your cities. And verse 15, and in anger and wrath I will execute vengeance upon the nations that did not obey. I take this to be a reference to the nations round about, because Israel and Judah were tempted to rely upon their strong neighbours, whether it's Egypt or Assyria or some other nation. They were tempted to rely upon these people, and God's going to strip them all away. So one by one he knocks away all of those things that they put their trust in, so that they might learn that besides God there was no salvation. Now here we are in our country. We have a wonderful country to live in. It is so easy to live here. Everything is so convenient. We have economic prosperity. We have national security. We have personal security. You can walk around the streets, you can do virtually whatever you want to do without real danger of any interference. We live in a very secure sort of an environment. And most Christians feel that this is now their right. Well, it's not our right at all. We have no God-given right that says God must protect this for us at all costs. Just look at Israel. They thought that God was obliged to look after them, to protect them from all the enemies, to maintain their nation as it was. And the prophets came along and says, look, you deceive yourselves. God has no obligation to protect you. If you're sinful and you go your own selfish way, then you cannot expect that God is going to preserve you in this state. God will send in enemies. He will destroy maybe the temple. He will destroy the nation. He maybe put you into captivity. And the people said, oh, he would never do that, because we are the chosen. We are Abraham's descendants. He made a covenant with us. He said, we are his people forever. He gave us this land. He said, this is the promised land, the land of Canaan. We'll drive out the enemies, and you can live here instead. They had all the verses, all the misconceptions that they had settled into, this complacency, and they felt God was obliged to preserve it for them. And unfortunately, the West has got itself into a similar mentality, that if there is a blow-up, or here we are in Australia, or any other country of the Western world, if there's a blow-up of international tensions or fighting or war, I think the assumption would be that God is on our side, and he would give us victory. He wouldn't allow some Muslim aggression, for example, to take over a Christian nation. But he allowed the Babylonians to take over Judah, and he allowed the Persians then to take over, and he allowed the Greeks and the Romans, even in New Testament times, in the time of Jesus. There was that promised land given to Abraham under the control of the Romans. And soon after the time of Jesus, Jerusalem was destroyed and the nation obliterated. God is not our servant. If we think we've got God there to do our bidding, then we are mistaken. And most Christians in our country, the reason why evangelism is not going ahead is that if it is not convenient for us to do it, we don't feel obliged to do it. But we have no right to this convenience. God is not duty bound to defend us or to preserve our standard of living. And if there was a war, then God is not necessarily going to be on our side, to use that expression. Do we really think this is a godly nation? Goodness me, there must be something wrong with us if we think that this nation is godly. When you look at example after example of how across the board there is an ungodliness, broken every rule in the book, every one of the Ten Commandments you can think of, the number of believers is comparatively small, very small. It's not a Christian nation. Perhaps we need a catastrophe to wake us up. Perhaps we need something, some calamity, to make us realize that our security is not guaranteed. And all the things that we put our trust in, whether it's military might, or a standard of living, or a welfare system, or a government, or security, or false religion, spiritism, New Age ideas, or whatever it is, none of those things are going to preserve us. Osama bin Laden, he really knew what he was doing. He might be an evil man, a wicked man, a terrorist, but he's not a fool. He is smart And he knows that if you want to hit the West, then you hit it where it hurts most. And when he flew those planes into America, two of them went for the two towers of the World Trade Center. The economy, Wall Street, hit the nation, hit the West at the very heart of the things it thinks most important, money and prosperity. And then one of them he flew into the Pentagon, smashed the Pentagon, the center of the military power, the defense system. And the third one, or the fourth actually, the fourth one, two into the Trade Center, one into the Pentagon, and the other one was heading for Washington, not quite sure whether it was heading for the White House or for the Capitol, the Congress, we would call a parliament in our country, the political center. It didn't get there, of course, it was ditched on the way through. But you see what he's done? You go for the economic center, you go for the military center, and you go for the political center. It's interesting that the other thing he didn't go for was the religious center. I don't know why, but maybe the religion is so weak, it's so pathetic in the Western world that it's not really worth bothering about all that much. But if you really want to hurt the West, then hit it in these two things that they prize so much: wealth and security. The security might come through the political system that we have that guarantees a reasonable living for all of us and enables us to live with a freedom. It's remarkable, really, in the context of this world where people don't have the sorts of freedoms we have. And it's protected by firepower, by military might. And of course, all of this preserves the wealth and the luxury and the self-indulgence of our lifestyle. Wealth and security, the two things that we are obsessed with in the Western world. If you had to single out two things that people in this country are obsessed with, it's money and personal security. Whether it's the personal security of investments and insurance and government welfare programs, or the wider picture of national security in a tense and uneasy world, these are the things that are at the center of most people's existence. And maybe God has got to wipe them out somehow. Maybe he's got to turn us upside down. Certainly, that is what Osama bin Laden was doing when he fired these planes. He was telling these people, I'm going to hit you where it hurts most. The things you most prize and the things you most cherish, your wealth and your economy, that's what I'm going to target. Now, the interesting thing is, as you go around the world and you look at these countries where their church is growing, some of them we've talked about this afternoon, and certainly many of these countries that I'm involved in and that I visit, if you look at those countries, most of them, those two features are lacking. In nearly all the places where the church is vigorous and growing, the people, or the country even, does not enjoy national prosperity, nor does it enjoy national security. In many of these cases, many of these places, the people themselves don't have the sort of social security that we enjoy here, or even just their domestic security. They're far more vulnerable to attacks and to thieves and robbers. And the country as a whole doesn't have the same sort of freedom of movement and the relaxed atmosphere that we have here. Many of them are involved in skirmishes, civil wars all over the country. And if not a civil war, then they have border conflict with hostile neighbours. And so the majority of these places are in a seething mass of tension and turmoil. But in that context, the church is growing. So the very things that we prize most, our wealth, our prosperity, our way of life, our standard of living, and our security, these things are lacking in the places where the church is most growing. Now, does this tell you something? Well, it certainly tells me something. It tells me that Christian strength, Christian vitality, church growth is not dependent upon wealth and national security. In fact, it seems to be better in the opposite setting: an absence of wealth, an absence of national security. And if you go to these places and you speak with these Christians, you find that their main concern in life is not the obsession that we have here with personal wealth and personal security. That's not their main interest in life. Of course they would like to be better off than they are. Of course they would like to live with a better standard of living than they have. But they are driven, I'm speaking of the Christians here, they are driven by a devotion to Christ, by a commitment to the gospel, a commitment to discipleship. And the church seems to grow always in those conditions. In fact, it looks to me as if the church can prosper in almost any set of circumstances you can think of, except circumstances of prosperity and wealth. And those are the circumstances of the West. And those are the circumstances where the church is finding it most difficult to grow. And maybe if there's going to be a wake-up in our country, then something has to be done to make us stop depending on these things, as it was with Israel. Don't depend on all of these other things that you're depending on. Firepower, idols, wealth, cities, agriculture. You're depending on these things instead of depending upon God. When we have something like September the 11th, or if you can think of some other type of crisis that we might encounter here, we say, oh, people will turn to God. But do they turn to God? Have the American people turned to God? Have the Australian people turned to God, or the British, or anybody else in the Western European world? What has been the upshot of this attack from the Al-Qaeda network? The upshot is not people turning to God. It's not people saying, oh, well, maybe we ought to lessen our obsession with wealth and well-being and security. No, there is not one sign that I have seen in any political or social statement from any leader, even in the church, to say nothing of in the political scene. I've seen nothing or heard nothing that has suggested we in the West have got to make a radical change in our value system, in our attitude to our standard of living, our wealth, our prosperity, our trade, in a world which is totally out of balance because so much is in the hands of so few and so many, the majority, are living in such difficulty. I haven't seen one statement or heard one statement that would suggest that there has been any shift whatever in the mentality of people in the Western world, and not even in the mentality of most Christians. All that's happened, the only change in their mentality, is to make them angrier. They're angrier with the Arabs, they're angrier with the Muslims, and they're determined to get square or to get even or to get rid of these people that have created the problem. They become more anti-Muslim, but they haven't become more pro-God. You see what I'm saying? The only changes have again to be interpreted in the context of people's own selfish lifestyles. And so it hasn't turned the people to God at all. But maybe, in some cases, you will find a change. It won't be across the board, but there will be those people who change. And I can think of one country I'd just like to give you an example of here before I close, is Yugoslavia, one that I've had quite a bit to do with. The church in Yugoslavia, like all its neighbours during the 50 years of communism, sat there and just preserved itself in the face of opposition. And so a mentality set in over 50 years that simply dug in trenches, manned the barracks, kept the enemy at bay, but the church did nothing about evangelizing. Now, they didn't have the opportunity to a large degree, and I must give full credit to these people for standing for the faith in the face of great opposition. And some of those countries really had it tough. But when freedom came, many of them didn't know what to do with it. And so a lot of these conservative Christians were still stuck there, just defending themselves. But then it took a few brave souls who said, we've got to start reaching out, and they started to change. And in Yugoslavia, I'm thinking of two people. One of them is Vladimir Majewski. He was here last year or the year before in our country. We had him here in our house, and we took him around some places. Some of you met him. He was a Brethren fellow, and a friend of his, Andre Franke, who was a Baptist chap. In the early 90s, they started a ministry of outreach, and they were looked at rather suspiciously by the conservative churches they came from, because they were starting to reach out of this ghetto. But they kept on. They got some other workers around them. They started radio work, youth work, children's work, welfare ministries, and they started to spread. And then, of course, during the 90s, came this disaster through the Balkans, all the bust up of former Yugoslavia. During those communist years, nobody in the church had even thought about evangelizing those in other regions. But now, when these men started, one thing grew onto another, and eventually they got a Bible school going, a training center, and they started to send people out, to train and send people out into other parts of former Yugoslavia. And then other parts of the country, other Christians, that is, churches in other parts of the country, they said, oh, maybe we could do something like this too. And slowly but surely, there grew a developing outreach. And out of all the chaos and suffering and disaster and mess that there was over those 10 years of conflict in the Balkans, out of that has come a new ministry that is reaching everywhere, reaching into Bosnia. Nobody had ever bothered about even trying to evangelize the Bosnians, or the people in Montenegro, or even Macedonia, or Kosovo for that matter. Many of these regions, the Christians had never even thought of them. They just looked after themselves. But after the chaos that came, and the suffering and the despair of those years, out of that has come a movement that has awoken the country. Because Christians said, we've got to get out of our comfort zone, we've got to get out of this ghetto that we have, and we've got to reach. And now there are, I think, over 150, roughly, 150 graduates from that training center that are now in Croatia, in Bosnia, in Serbia, in Montenegro, Macedonia, in Kosovo, evangelizing people that they had never thought about before. God sometimes has to tip us on our head. He's got to send us a catastrophe, something enormous that's going to somehow wake us up and stir us up. Now, I'm not a prophet, I'm not going to predict what he might do to Australia. But I am saying that we must take stock of ourselves. This message is going to be lost on the politicians, it's going to be lost on the business leaders, on the social gurus of our country, but please not on us in the church. That we might not be depending on all of these things that we think are important, but instead stripping ourselves of them as best we can, shifting our center of activity, shifting the balance of our cash and our prosperity, shifting it out of where we are and shifting it into some other places. And then we might know, I am the Lord, and beside me there is no Savior. What is it that you and I are depending upon? What is it that you and I understand as the sort of life that Jesus Christ has called us to?